you were standing on the Mount of Olives, on the southern end of the Mount of Olives, and were looking west, you'd be looking back into the city of Jerusalem. And the first thing you'd see, what would dominate your vision, as a matter of fact, is the Temple Mount, Mount Zion, the mountain on which Solomon built the temple that had been planned and financed by David, torn down by the Babylonians in 586, rebuilt 70 years later by Zerubbabel. And then by the time we get to the New Testament, King Herod had spent many years renovating and remodeling not just the temple, but that entire Temple Mount area. It's a beautiful view, breathtaking view, as a matter of fact, for a number of different reasons. I want to back away a little bit, though, just bring the lens of the camera back a little bit and show you that same picture in a little broader view, because and what I want you to notice especially is all of this. And just as far as the eye can see, as a matter of fact, you know what that is? You know what those are? You can just nod your head. You don't have to say anything. But those are graves. There are thousands of them. And they're on both sides of the valley, both of the hills of the valley. The Kidron Valley runs between the Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount, the city of Jerusalem. And on the slopes of both of those mountains, you have these graves. And there are very strict requirements about who can be buried in this particular cemetery. Generally speaking, only Jews, and not even every Jew qualifies to be buried in this cemetery. You turn a little bit toward the north, and another view of all of these graves. And there's another cemetery up here on the other side of the Kidron Valley, which is north of the city of Jerusalem, which is a Protestant seminary. So if you wanted to be buried in Jerusalem, but you could not prove that you were a Jew, then if you were granted permission, you could be buried up here in the Protestant seminary. This is just another view. It was staggering to see how many of them there are. And all of these are vaults that are built above ground. I think I have another picture or two that gives you a little bit clearer view of that and of this cemetery. And again, the cemetery, except for the Mount of Olives, the Garden of Gethsemane, which is north of where these pictures are being taken from, you have these graves are everywhere on the slopes of these hills. And again, this gives you a little bit clearer picture of how people are buried. The box is built above the ground, and then the coffin would be set down in the box, and of course you can visit those. I said a few minutes ago that there are very strict requirements about who can be buried on either side in the Jewish cemeteries, who can be buried on either side of the Kidron Valley. But there are a few exceptions. There are some Gentiles who have been allowed to be buried in this Jewish cemetery. For example, this is a grave that you can visit in Jerusalem if you ever get a chance to go, but Oscar Schindler, who was a German and a Gentile, was granted permission by the Israeli government to be buried in the Jewish cemetery. There aren't many Gentiles who are buried in the Jewish cemetery, but he's one of them. I want to show you a mausoleum in the Protestant cemetery in Jerusalem. In this mausoleum are buried members of an organization that was called the American Colony. The American Colony was founded in the late 1800s by people who were interested even then in returning Jerusalem to the people that they believed to be the rightful inheritors of Jerusalem, and that is the Jews. So they started this organization called the American Colony. They built schools, they built hospitals. There are a lot of very wealthy Americans and some wealthy Europeans lived in the American Colony. And one of the men whose name is on this marker, you can see it, but you can't see it in the slide, but that's the name of Horatio Gates Spafford. And this is a picture that Brother Jenkins took of in the Protestant cemetery of Spafford. I want to tell you a little bit about Spafford and about his wife, Anna. Horatio Spafford was an attorney in the city of Chicago. And he was a well-known attorney and very prosperous attorney. And he and some friends of his were wealthy enough that they were actually speculating in land. They were buying and selling real estate. Spafford lost almost everything that he had. His house was not touched, but all of his real estate holdings, his law office, most of his fortune was lost in the Chicago fire in October of 1871. The Chicago fire is the fire that was supposedly started when Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lantern and set the shed on fire. Whether that's true or not, the fact of the matter is that a large portion of the city of Chicago was destroyed in that fire. And Spafford lost most of what he had. Trying to recover from that, Spafford decided that he and his wife and his four daughters, the oldest was 11 or 12, the youngest little girl was just an infant baby, that they would go to Europe, that they would get away from Chicago for a while. And so he booked passage on a ship for he and his wife and his four daughters to go to Europe. At the last minute, something came up that caused Horatio Spafford, to have to stay in Chicago. But they decided not to spoil the vacation for the girls. And so Anna Spafford and these four girls got on the ship and they headed toward Europe. At some point, not too far off the coast of Nova Scotia, in the middle of a dark night, with a new moon, so very little light, and nobody knows exactly how it happened. They were on a French liner, a French ship. An English ship coming from the other direction rammed this French ship, and both ships went down. Both ships sank, and hundreds of people died. Spafford heard about that, of course. He heard about it pretty quickly. But remember that this is in the 1870s. And Spafford has no way of knowing what happened to his wife and daughters. All he can do is wait. He knows that there were survivors. But he doesn't know if his wife and daughters were survivors. 11 days after he got the news that the ship had sunk. And can you imagine waiting 11 days to get news about your wife and children? He got this telegram from his wife from Nova Scotia. Saved alone. What shall I do? All four of the girls had drowned. As a matter of fact, the baby, Anna Spafford, was holding the baby in her arms, one arm, and trying to cling to a piece of wreckage in the other arm. And the baby was pulled away from her in the current. And she watched the baby disappear beneath the waves, and the baby was gone. All four babies were gone. Spafford then makes arrangements to go immediately to his wife. She has gone on to England. And he gets on a ship, and he starts for London, starts for England. 2 or 3 or 4 days into the trip, the captain of the ship that Spafford was sailing on called him up to the bridge and said, I just wanted you to know that we've been working out these longitudes and latitudes to the best of our ability to understand them. And right now, we're passing over the site of the wreckage of the ship that took the lives of your four daughters. The story is that Spafford went back to his cabin and he took a piece of paper and he wrote down the words to what became a song. I want to show you. This is not the original document. It's not the original paper upon which he wrote them. But when he got to England, when he got on to Holland, staying in a motel, he wrote it down on this sheet of paper. These are the words to the song that we're going to sing in a few minutes when we extend the invitation. It is well with my soul. That song, the words to that song were written. The idea, the thought for that song came into Spafford's mind when he was passing over the site where his four daughters had died. Now, that's all I'm going to say about Spafford for the moment. I'll come back to the song in just a few minutes. The story about Spafford, Horatio Spafford and Anna Spafford, it doesn't end there. It's fascinating. It goes on. Spafford and his wife had more children. He and his wife were two of the founders of the American colony. One of his daughters wrote a biography of him. That I'm reading now, one of the amazing things about e-books and electronic versions of books is that so many old things that have been out of print have come back in print. It's a fascinating story. They had other children, in other words. But this song, It Is Well With My Soul, was written as a result of that story that I just told you about the death of Spafford's four daughters. And it is beyond the ability of some people, I think maybe even it's beyond the ability of me sometimes, to comprehend how he could pen those words under those circumstances. That he could say what he said under those circumstances, It Is Well With My Soul. It is an incredible song. We sang it, and as a matter of fact, I say we sang it. Some of you all sang it, and I sat and listened at the singing a few weeks ago. I believe Brother Austin Byers was leading the song. And, the words to that song are incredible. But I heard Bill Hall say one time many years ago that the one thing that will come the closest to making hypocrites out of those of us who are Christians are the words to the songs that we sing. Do we, when we sing, It Is Well With My Soul, do we really mean that? Do we really comprehend and understand that regardless of our situation or circumstances in life, it is well with my soul? What I want to do, and again, I'll come back to the song in just a few minutes if you'll be patient with me. What I want to do with you is I want to suggest to you, I think Spafford was a man of faith. I make no pronouncement at all upon his relationship with God. But there's no question that he was a man of faith, and very strong faith, as a matter of fact. Faith that I think probably embarrasses me. Or puts me to shame. How could he write those words? He could write those words because he knew and understood something about God that it is vital, brethren, that we know and understand. It is well with my soul, and I want to share five things with you just very quickly in the lesson this morning, and the lesson will be yours. How could he say that? How can we say it? How can we sing it and really mean it? That regardless of what is happening to us in our lives, it is well with my soul. Five things. The first one is this. It is well with my soul because regardless of what's going on with me, regardless of what's going on around me, God is in control. God is on His throne. Look with me, if you will, at just a few passages. For example, Hebrews chapter 1. We're studying the book of Hebrews in the auditorium Bible class, and the book of Hebrews begins with this affirmation that God is in control. God is in charge. The author of the book of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3, He is the radiance of His glory and the exact representation of His nature. And He upholds all things by the word of His power. He upholds all things by the word of His power. The planet exists. The solar system. The universe. The galaxy. It all exists. And it all functions and operates in exactly the way it does because God is in control. The author of the book of Colossians, the Apostle Paul, and this is a major part of Paul's reasoning in Colossians chapter 1 about the nature of Christ, the nature of God. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 16, talking about Christ, he says, Colossians 1 and verse 16, For by Him all things were created, both in the heavens and on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him and for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body of the church, the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that He Himself will come to have first place in everything. And brethren, we need to know and understand something. That's true regardless of what's happening to me. I mean, that's true of whether things are going well for me. It's true that God is in control, that He holds or sustains everything by the power of His hand. If things are going badly for me, and nothing in my life, brethren, even approaches how badly things were going for Horatio Spafford in the 1870s. Remember I said he had just lost in the Chicago fire almost all of his fortune. And now he loses his four daughters, one of them a baby, on top of that. And he's able to say, in the midst of all of that, it is well with my soul. I'm confident that he knew and understood that God is in control. Go back to Isaiah chapter 40, one more passage. Isaiah chapter 40, beginning in verse 28. This is God speaking through the prophet Isaiah. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary. And to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. And how can I, and especially when things are going badly, how can I sing, how can I say and really mean it, it is well with my soul? I think, first of all, I need to make sure that I understand that no matter what's going on in this world, God is in control. I don't know how you feel about the sequester. I don't even know what that means. I was on a jury one time that was sequestered. That's got me a little worried now that it's something that the federal government is doing. And I tell you what, people in the world are in despair about what's going to happen to us economically. It really doesn't matter. God is in control. God is in control. And whatever happens to the economy of the United States of America, it is well with my soul. Whoever occupies the White House or Congress or the governor's mansion, it is well with my soul. Whatever happens to my retirement, it is well with my soul. Can we say that? Can we say that? Can we say it with Paul in Philippians chapter 4? I have learned in whatever situation I find myself therein to be content. It is well with my soul, secondly, because all things work together for good. Of course, that's Paul in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. I have suggested, the members here have heard this before, I've suggested, for the sake of the visitors, I'll say it again many times, that I think Romans 8 and verse 28 is one of the most misunderstood and misapplied passages in all of the New Testament. We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. And I would suggest to you this morning that that does not mean that if you are a Christian, if you're in a right relationship with God, that everything's going to be great. And you won't ever have to deal with catastrophes like the one with which Horatio and Anna Spafford had to deal. You'll never lose your retirement. You'll never be diagnosed with cancer. You'll never hear that one of your children has been diagnosed with cancer. That is precisely the way that the vast majority of people in the religious world apply Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. Even in the context, that is a misapplication of the passage. In the context, Paul's talking about God's plan to save men and women from their sins. And the fact of the matter is, all things work together for good means that God has a plan and that God is working things. I think, well, I started to say we won't go back there for the sake of time, but it's just one verse. Look at Genesis chapter 50. This is Joseph. You know, Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers, and then he was cast into prison by Potiphar because of an accusation that Potiphar's wife made against him. Joseph went through some extremely hard times, but in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20, Joseph says this about all those bad things that happened to him. As for you, let's start with verse 19. Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for," he's talking to his brothers, "as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. God let me go through torment. He let me be beaten. He let me be imprisoned. He let me be falsely accused of rape or attempted rape. Why did he do all of that? He did it for good. He had a plan to preserve his people. And he was using Joseph." The fact of the matter is, the same thing's true about Jesus, is it not? Jesus' life was not a bed of roses. Jesus suffered. And we're told in passages like Acts chapter 3 and verse 26, "For you first God raised up His servant and sent Him to bless you by turning every one of you from your wicked ways." The beatings, the crown of thorns, the nails that attached Him to the cross, the humiliation, all of the things that Christ suffered, God intended all of that for good. For our spiritual good, for our ultimate spiritual well-being. And so, it is well with my soul because I know that whatever is going on in my life, God intends good for me. Now, good doesn't mean health. Good doesn't mean financial prosperity. Good doesn't mean no family problems. Good means that I understand and know that as a Christian that it really doesn't matter what's going on around me. I can be a Christian. I can be in a right relationship with God. And no matter what's going on, I can maintain the hope that I have of being in God, with God in heaven in eternity. It is well with my soul because I know that God is working everything together for my good. Number three, I can sing, I hope, with the same conviction with which Spafford wrote those words, "It is well with my soul because I know that troubles are only temporary." And we're not ever intended to last. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning in verse 16, the Apostle Paul says this, 2 Corinthians 4, beginning in verse 16. "Therefore, we do not lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal," temporary. "But the things which are not seen are eternal." You know, how do we cope with bad news? How do we cope with challenges, with problems in life? We remember that this life is just temporary. And that what we're looking for, what we're striving for, is something beyond this life. In Revelation chapter 21, for example, in verse 4, "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And there will be no longer any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain, because the first things will have passed away." There is an incredible peace that comes with being in a right relationship with God. I suspect that people in the world would look at the lyrics of this song and read the story about what prompted the writing of those lyrics and suggest that Horatio Gates Spafford was mentally unbalanced. That's not a natural or a normal relation to that kind of devastating and gut-wrenching tragedy. The fact of the matter is, that is the exact response and reaction to that kind of gut-wrenching tragedy. It's difficult for me to imagine and conceive how people deal with situations like that in the absence of God. If God is not a part of the picture, if I don't have a knowledge that however bad this is, it's only temporary. And I'm going to be someplace, hopefully, I'm going to be someplace ultimately one day where none of these kinds of things can ever happen again. No tears, no death, no infant baby being pulled away from the arms of its mother, never to be seen again. Or every kind of tragic situation, every kind of difficulty that you can imagine or conceive of in life. Nothing like that. That's what we're striving for. We're striving to get to heaven. And so we can have peace. We can have tremendous peace. James chapter 1, verses 2, 3, and 4. "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance," or patience, "and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Understand and recognize that even when trials come, there's good that can come from that. And it's only temporary. It passes. Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says it like this. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 11. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. A child of God, a Christian, should have the ability to view the situations and the circumstances that confront us in life, good or bad, with the right perspective. And that is, it's only temporary. It's only temporary. I've made points like this in sermons before, and I've had young people come up to me and say, that doesn't resonate with me. I didn't understand that. You know, and when you get to talking with them, and what you discover is they've never experienced any hardships in their life. They've never experienced any tragedy in their life. All of their loved ones are still living. They've never had major surgery. They've never been in an automobile accident. That's probably true of a number of young people in the audience here. And for a long time, I didn't know how to respond to that. I'm not sure I'm responding the best way now. But all I know to say now to young people or anyone who says, I don't have troubles. I don't understand that. That doesn't mean anything to me, is this. First of all, God bless you if that's true. I hope you're on your knees every day thanking God for the fact that you haven't experienced catastrophe and suffering in your life. But know this, that if you stick around this old world long enough, you will. You will know it. And you will know it intimately and personally. And you're going to have to deal with it. You're going to have to face it. You're going to have to be able to say at the end of the day that something terrible has happened, but it is well with my soul. Because I know this is characteristic of a sinful world, and I'm trying to get home to heaven where these kinds of things won't happen. Let me suggest to you number four. I can say with conviction, it is well with my soul because of the universal nature of salvation. I'm not going to look at these passages. They're familiar to us. John 3:16, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. The gospel makes it possible for anyone, the richest, the poorest, any race, any age, any social background or situation, to be in a right relationship with God. I really, and especially now, knowing the story of Horatio and Anna Spafford, and knowing the circumstances in which he wrote that song. And incidentally, the song that we have in our songbook is not the entire song. There are several other verses that he wrote that are generally not included in our songbooks. But when you go back and you read the words and understand and recognize the circumstances in which he wrote them, he again, I have no knowledge at all of his own personal individual relationship with God. But he knew and understood something that it is essential that we know and understand. And that is, because salvation is available to all, because it's available to me, I can deal with, I can handle the bad things that happen in this life. And at the end of the day, when the worst things happen to me in this life, it doesn't have any impact on my salvation unless I allow it to. It might have an impact on my relationship with my family. It might impact my job. It might impact my education. It might impact my health. But it cannot impact my salvation unless I allow it to. That I can go through the valley of the shadow of death, which doesn't, in the 23rd Psalm, necessarily mean what we think it means in some circumstances. But I can endure that. I can handle that because God is my shepherd. Because of the relationship that I have with God. And number five, I can sing with conviction, it is well with my soul, because the end result is victory. Do any of you, and I will confess that I do this occasionally, do any of you feel so strongly about your sports teams that you can't bear to watch them play live? And so you record the games and watch them later, but only after you've learned that they won the game. I mean, those are the fun games to watch. You know they won. You know they were behind right at the end of the game. You know that they hit the three-pointer. You know that they threw the touchdown pass as time expired. And I tell you, when I watch those replays of games like that, from beginning to end, I watch it with a smile on my face. Even when the interception is thrown, even when the free throw is missed, that's nothing, because I know the outcome. I know how it ends. And might I suggest to you that I think we've wasted, and this is my opinion, but I think we've wasted a lot of time down through the years in our efforts to date the book of Revelation. Was it written before Jerusalem was destroyed, or was it written after Jerusalem was destroyed? And sometimes people will ask me, well, are you an early dater or are you a late dater? Well, if you're talking about dating girls, I was definitely a late dater. But if you're talking about dating the book of Revelation, my response is I'm a no dater. And for the last number of years when I've taught the book of Revelation, I will mention the different views that people take on the date in the first lesson, and then forget it. Because we get so caught up in dating the book that we lose the message. The message of the book of Revelation is victory is assured. It's over. You know what you're reading in the Bible is equivalent to watching the taped replay of the Kentucky National Championship game. They already won. You know they won. How many times have some of y'all watched that since then? You know they won, and you watch it with a big grin on your face. How can we sing? How can we say it is well with my soul without that conviction of knowing the battle's over? One of the great misunderstandings that people in the religious world have about Satan is that he is somehow or another a spiritual being who is co-equal with God. You think about all the books that have been written on that basis, all the movies that have been directed and produced on that basis. You have God and you have Satan, and they're fighting each other, and nobody knows who's going to win, depending on this baby or depending on this group of, you know, knights or this, I mean, just whatever it is. That is absolutely not the picture that is presented in the Bible. The picture presented in the Bible is that Satan is a created being, and he tried to defeat God, and God just flicked him off with his finger and bound him and sent him down to earth, restricted his power. The battle's over. It's over. God won. There was never any question that God was going to win. Salvation is for all, and the end result is victory. If today or tomorrow, me or you, if any of us were to lose every physical material possession, the end result would still be victory if we maintain our faith. If we were to lose every person that we loved, the end result is still victory. The end result is still victory. We have that hope of being in heaven with God in eternity, and nothing can take that away from us. I want you to notice with me, if you will, and we're going to sing this song in just a moment. It's not a typical invitation song, but we're going to sing it anyway. But I want you, and I'm not going to go through the whole song, just the first couple of lines. Look what Spafford said, and remember, he's on a ship, and the ship is passing over the spot where somewhere beneath that ship lie the remains of his four infant daughters. And he writes these words. And the first words that he writes are these: when peace like a river attendeth my way. I think it's impressive and incredible, as a matter of fact, that he starts the song with those words. When peace like a river attendeth my way. Everything's going great. When everything's going great, And I just have the peace that passes understanding. Peace just flows like a river out of me. When that is true, it is well with my soul. My guess is that all of us could sing that or say that with conviction. You know, I'm feeling good. I'm happy. I'm getting good grades. I got a good job. I'm in a good relationship. I've got a car that I don't have to be ashamed or embarrassed to drive. Everything's going great. It is well with my soul. But the very next line, he's on a ship, remember. And his daughter's drowned. And he writes, when sorrows like sea billows roll. There have been a couple of times in my life when sorrows rolled like waves. That's when it really becomes hard to say, it is well with my soul. That's when it really becomes challenging. When peace like a river attendeth my way, it's easy to say, it is well with my soul. When sorrows like sea billows roll, that's when it really takes faith. It really takes commitment. It really takes belief in God, on His throne and in control, and giving me salvation that nothing except my own choice can take away from me, and giving me the hope of being with Him in heaven in eternity, in circumstances and in a situation that will be so radically different from what we know here. So that now I can say, when sorrows like sea billows roll, it is well with my soul. Whatever my lot, you know, whatever's happening to me in life, whatever my lot, Thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. It is well with my soul. Five reasons again. I want to do something and just put the five reasons back up. But I want to go back to the 46th Psalm. I'm going to read it again, as a matter of fact. You can follow along if you'd like, but you may have a little hard time following because I'm going to be reading from the Scottish Metrical Psalter. I love this. Psalters are common. They've been around for centuries. Psalters are generally attempts to take the Psalms and to put them in meter and rhyme so that they can be sung. Certainly the Psalms were sung initially, but the meter, the rhyme loses something translating from one language to another translation. So people in different languages down through the centuries have devised psalters. This is the Scottish Psalter. It dates back to at least the 17th century, I think, and in the 1600s, maybe older than that. But this is the 46th Psalm, which Sam read for us very capably from probably the New English Standard Translation a few minutes ago. This is the Scottish Psalter. God is our refuge and our strength, in straits a present aid. Therefore, although the earth remove, we will not be afraid. Though hills amidst the seas be cast, though waters roaring make, and troubled be, yea, though the hills by swelling seas do shake. A river is, whose streams do glad, the city of our God, the holy place wherein the Lord Most High hath His abode. God in the midst of her doth dwell, nothing shall her remove. The Lord to her an helper will, and that right early prove. The heathen raged tumultuously, the kingdoms moved were. The Lord God uttered His voice, the earth did melt for fear. The Lord of hosts upon our side doth constantly remain. The God of Jacob is our refuge, us safely to maintain. Come and behold what wondrous works have by the Lord been wrought. Come see what desolations He on earth hath brought. Unto the ends of all the earth, wars into peace He turns. The bow He breaks, the spear He cuts, in fire the chariot burns. Verses 10 and 11, I love this. Be still and know that I am God. Among the heathen I will be exalted. I on earth will be exalted high. our God, who is the Lord of hosts, is still upon our side. The God of Jacob, our refuge forever, will abide. What about you? Can you say, whether you're a Christian or not, if you're not a Christian, then certainly it would not be possible for you to sing with conviction, "It is well with my soul." Because the worst possible thing is true about your soul, and that is that it's separated from God. And runs the risk of being separated from God in all eternity if you don't make some changes in your life. But what about those of us who are Christians? As we sing the words to this song, thank you, Rob, for being willing to do that for us this morning. As we sing the words to this song, let's sing it with conviction. That it is true, that when peace like a river attends my way, it is well with my soul. Even when sorrows like sea billows roll, it's still well with my soul. Because of my God. We want to help you make Him your God this morning. We want to bring you back into a right relationship with Him, if that's what you need to do. Again, the words to the song don't necessarily imply invitation or inviting, but we're using it as an invitation song. While we sing these words, if there's anything that we can help you do at all to be in a right relationship with God, please step out into the aisle, come down to one of these front seats, and let us take care of that right now. While we stand and sing, we invite you to come.